Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Tim Cortese. In this special episode of Oncology on the Go, we invited Dr. Nicholas Hornstein of Northwell Health to our home studio in Cranberry, New Jersey, to speak about GI cancers and what to expect at the 2026 ASCO annual meeting.
Dr. Hornstein, thank you for agreeing to talk to me and making your way all the way out here to Cranberry, New Jersey.
Hey, it was a nice ride out. Thank you for having me. Excited to chat a little bit.
Fantastic. So just before we begin, can you just, you know, give an introduction, you know, your name, your title, your institution?
My name is Nick Hornstein. I'm a GI medical oncologist with a focus on below-the-belt malignancies, so mostly colorectal cancer, but some anal and appendiceal as well. I'm at Northwell Health and have been there for the last 2 years, really focusing on trying to do better for these patients, clinical trial design, implementation, and then some health system work as well.
Fantastic. So no need to waste any time. Let's just get right into this. I know you had a busy studio filming before this. We don't have the same games that you had played there, but just some general questions, some clinical questions. ASCO is coming up, and over the past year, a lot's happened in the colorectal cancer space, the GI cancer space. But how would you say colorectal cancer has just evolved, not specifically, just like broadly in terms of over the past year?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. We look in oncology in general, and many of the new fancy, shiny tools and therapies come in non-small cell lung cancer. It's the poster child, right, in terms of it being responsive and having a pretty large population of patients that can benefit. So we see these trials coming out and these agents coming out there, as well as in some ways in rarer tumors like cholangiocarcinoma. And we are just sitting here in colorectal cancer land with these patients who have targets. And finally, we're seeing them make their way into clinical practice. So we had Breakwater come out over the last year and a half or so. So moving targeted therapy for BRAF P600E into the first line. We're seeing more changes now coming in with anti-HER2. So we had Mountaineer and Destiny, and I think there's many more in the pipeline. And then there's some approvals coming in upper GI space. We expect Jazz has a bispecific anti-HER2, Zahira, I think is the brand name. But that'll be coming there very, very soon, and I expect it's going to land in the colorectal space in the not-too-distant future. So we see these things in trials. We see these RAS inhibitors that a lot of people have been talking about lately. And I'm really just excited for what's coming next.
Yeah, those RAS inhibitors are everywhere right now. Specifically, are there any specific patient groups you'd say you've had the most moment in the colorectal cancer space, in the GI space?
The most moment, you mean?
Most movement, I should say.
Most movement, okay. I think there's a few. One is the management, as I mentioned, BRAF V600D positive metastatic colon patients has had a tremendous shift. The second is MSI high. Probably should have mentioned this earlier, but it's a different disease. MSI high in any space, whether that's PDAC and the 1-2% that have it, or colorectal for the 5-15% that do. Different disease entity, needs to be thought of as differently. We are now able to walk into a room, meet a patient with either localized or very advanced disease and potentially cure them, which is crazy. You know, you can count on one hand the number of solid tumors you can cure when they're widely metastatic. We can do that now. So I'm really hopeful for the future for learning how to take this immunotherapy-based approach and apply it to more patients. And there's a lot of really interesting studies about how to cause more neoantigens to form in tumors. We're not there yet, but at a minimum, we know we have a subpopulation of patients that have huge benefits. So in terms of moving the needle, they are, by and large, the greatest benefactors of having new therapeutics.
Okay, great. And then you touched on Breakwater, which is one of the bigger trials in GI recently.
Yeah.
Earlier today, you ranked it number two on a list of trials, only topped by Resolute 302, which is Resolute 302. So in Corafenib, Cetuximab, and Empil-Fox-6, or just chemotherapy in general, FOLFIRI. It's been about a year since, I guess it's been a year and a half. It was received accelerated approval in 2024 and TRAD approval in February this year.
Yeah.
What's it been like? Just are all patients eligible with BRAF V600E getting that? And then, I guess, are you expecting anything from the oil abstract this year?
Yeah. So let's start with the end of the question. This year, what are we expecting? It's a victory lap. We know this is a positive trial. If anyone is saying anything otherwise, they probably need to read more into the literature and really have some introspection about that decision. You mentioned something important. We have updated data this year that using FOLFIRI in the first line instead of FOLFOX works. I know this is more in line with our European colleagues, but it also belays some of the concern about patients developing neuropathy on breakwater. And that probably is a byproduct of the fact that they are living for longer and on treatment longer, and you're giving them more oxaliplatin. Guess what? They're going to have neuropathy. There's no off-ramp in the original study. So in real clinical practice, we don't give oxaliplatin until you can't walk. It's an important study. I think it is absolutely the go-to for these patients, and there needs to be a very, very strong rationale for not using it. Like a patient says, hey, I'm allergic to cetuximab or anti-EGFR. Outside of that, I haven't yet found a case where I am not using targeted therapy in the first line setting, and I have a reasonable number of patients on the regimen. In talking to others, I haven't yet heard of a reason not to do that. Maybe in the setting of very advanced disease and the patient's going to hospice instead of therapy. But barring that, no, you probably should start, and you should start with the full treatment. We know that if you don't give it in the first line, if let's say you wait to implement Beacon, which is second line BRAF V600E targeted therapy, you're going to lose a significant percentage of patients who progress and progress so rapidly and quickly that they deteriorate and they don't make it to second line therapy. So we have our data. We know our survival is, you know, pushing well beyond what you would get for PFS2 in terms of using it in the second line. And I can't think of a rationale not to give it in the first line.
Okay, great. And then, as you just said, when it first came, it was mFOLFOX6 was what was known to be proven. And now we recently just had this FOLFIRI data come out. What are you looking towards? Is it always full mFOLFOX6? What are the conditions where you might swap for FOLFIRI?
Medical oncologists go to school for like 20 years. There's a reason we haven't just been replaced with AI yet. And part of it is shared decision-making, talking about toxicity, side effect profile. We know oxaliplatin can cause neuropathy, can be debilitating. So some patients prefer irinotecan. You get hair loss, you get other issues. But really, for the most part in the U.S., we're doing mFOLFOX. I tend to do mFOLFOX6 Ancocetux and then move into 5-FU Ancocetux as a maintenance strategy. And then at the time of progression, I add on irinotecan. So that's kind of my playbook for the disease. And I've been really pleased with the results.
Okay, fantastic. Phenomenal to hear. Next line of therapy, after breakwater progression, what are you looking towards?
After you progress on BRAF V600E targeted therapy, both oxaliplatin and irinotecan, you run into some challenges. There are next generation BRAF inhibitors that are kind of on the horizon, that are in clinical trials, that potentially might overcome some of the resistance mechanisms. You know, we learned early on that we needed to add on an EGFR because that was an escape mechanism. But as you mentioned, you're still having patients that progress. So we don't have really much in our back pocket right now. I had a patient the other day in clinic who is progressing on FOLFIRI Ancocetux after FOLFOX Ancocetux, and it's a very hard conversation to have because the disease is so aggressive with the BRAF mutation. So we have our third line options, and then we have clinical trials. But I wish I had a better answer than that.
You just touched on clinical trials. And there is a rapid oral coming out at ASCO this year, tumlimetinib and vemurafenib, dual blockade. So how does this affect practice?
So that trial is interesting to me for a few reasons. The combination of drugs are basically developed and implemented in China. So we're looking at new regulatory pathway. It's not U.S. first, as many are. And I think we're seeing this increasingly. So I'm keeping an eye on a few oral abstracts presented at ASCO where the data and the drug are both designed and the trial is run outside of the U.S., mostly in China. And I think it's important to keep in mind that there are alternative pathways like that. where we're going to be getting data and we're going to have to learn how to interpret it in a non-US population. So for that study in particular, if I recall correctly, the patients on that trial didn't need to be treated with previous targeted therapy. So can we bring it directly to the US and use it apples to apples? Absolutely not. I think we really are going to need to see the data. We're going to need to ingest it. We're going to need to see the patient population that's treated. And then we're going to have to learn what level of evidence do we need to try to evaluate these things. Is it going to need to be another trial run in the US and evaluated here? Potentially and probably, just because we have different practices between our countries and between different segments of the world.
Okay, great. And now stepping away from the BRAF V600, looking more towards HER2 positive disease, what are you looking towards in your, what's your preferred therapy for a chemorefractory metastatic colorectal cancer patient with HER2 positive disease?
Yeah, so there's two regimens that we can reach for. The first is the Mountaineer VACE regimen with TKI therapy, which is fantastic for the right patients. And then the other is looking more towards something like T-DXd based on the DESTINY studies. I personally weigh a little bit more towards T-DXd, but both have their time and their place in the clinic, and I am using both of them. I think that I'm excited for, you know, the evolution of therapy there. We have some bispecifics that are going to be coming to the clinic very, very soon in bigger form, and I'm thinking of one in particular. My hope is that we get these agents that might be a little bit more effective and either can salvage in the refractory space, post-progression, or if you have the opportunity to use them up front.
Okay, great. So you're already looking at ADCs in that population.
So we're looking at ADCs. We're looking at bispecifics. Ziihera is one that is going to be coming in very soon. I expect FDA approval of that in the upper GI space. We're going to have that as a tool. But there's also trials running kind of pan-cancer that we'll be able to use.
Okay, and I know at ASCO there's another phase 3 reporting on in that population, HER2 positive with trastuzumab, rezatecan in that population. Any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, so rezatecan, another China-based study, right? So we're seeing all these agents coming in, again, alternative pathways. The data looks really good that's come out for that agent in terms of the proportion of patients who develop ILD, response rates. Clearly, they've taken a page from the T-DXd playbook. But again, this is going to be a patient population that is different than the U.S. population. We can't compare one-to-one. We're going to need to really think hard as a community about how we assess this data and what level of evidence we need to start considering it in clinical practice.
Fantastic. So moving on to my next question here. You actually published, or you created this really comprehensive ASCO GI kind of trial preview abstracts to look at for ASCO coming forward in the GI space. And one of your top ones was the CIRCULATE trial, which is looking at can ctDNA prospectively help guide if you should skip adjuvant chemo.
Mm-hmm.
If that reads positively, you did say it changes how you counsel all your patients with stage 2 colon cancer. So can you just go into that a little bit?
Yeah, so we actually have a lot of evidence that's been coming up over the last 5 years looking at how ctDNA might play a role in adjuvant colon cancer counseling. We have the original data out of CIRCULATE Japan, which shows us that this is a really excellent tool to gain more information. We also are getting more information from studies like BESPOKE, for example, and some others that are showing us that in patients who are not what I would consider high risk, or T4 or N2, that it might already be prime time to use them. I think it's a hard decision to make. You're weighing the risk benefit, and it should be part of shared decision making. But as these assays are improving over time, and they're constantly getting better, right? If you're looking at, you know, the Natera of today versus an assay that was developed some time ago or an assay that's coming. So Exact Science has, you know, a newer MRD assay that looks to be pretty promising that's not out yet. I can only say that it's going to get better, and our ability to identify smaller and smaller amounts of residual disease is only going to improve. So if the studies now are either equivocal or slightly positive or non-inferior, the actual term I should be using, that's only going to get better. So in my practice for low risk, for stage two patients in general, I'm already using ctDNA to help guide decision making, and I'm de-escalating patients. Certainly, I'm escalating patients. So even if I have a stage two that's low risk, if they're ctDNA positive, they're getting chemo, right? But for a T4 N2 patient, I don't think the technology is ready quite yet. I think as newer generations come online, we're going to have more confidence in using them in that de-escalation setting. And then we're also going to have some US-based studies. Remember, a number of these de-escalation studies were New Zealand and Australia-based. We're going to have US-based studies
Circulate.
That are going to tell us a little bit more about how we can use it here, both for escalation and de-escalation.
So I guess moving on, just in general in colorectal cancer care, it's a bit of a broad question, but what do you say is just the biggest unmet need?
I think there's a lot of ways to answer that. From my perspective, developing new drugs, new assays, new tools takes a long time. And there's the moonshot, right? Moonshot would be, how do we cure every patient with something like immunotherapy? But then there's the ground shot. How do we make sure every patient with a targetable mutation or phenotype is receiving that agent against that target? And I think we need to be focusing on both. I think that rates of biomarker testing in the US in certain regions are abysmal. When you're hearing that only half of patients are getting things like sequencing or MSI testing in the metastatic setting, that should make your head turn. So yes, we do need to develop next generation. We do need to do better for every patient who's progressing. We also need to make sure that every patient is getting the right testing so that we can recommend the right treatments for them. Because if you don't know a patient's HER2 positive, what's it matter if you have a really effective anti-HER2 agent? So I think that, you know, coming together as a community, ensuring that we're all keeping up with education is really important. It's also really hard, right? I'm pretty niche. I focus on GI oncology, and it's even there hard to keep up to date all the time. But trying to figure out what is the best mechanism to ingest new information, new knowledge, it's important.
Fantastic. And I guess in the spirit of kind of advancements and developing new things, just looking at ASCO, what are the trials that you're most looking at for like standard of care changes, or that just, you know, the headline trials?
Yeah, I mean, we all know our plenary. There's one GI study there, which is RASolute 302 second line pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma after progression on chemotherapy with a actionable RAS mutation. That has more or less already changed the standard of care. It's not even approved yet, and yet it's all over the news. Patients are calling in trying to get it on expanded access. Should overnight change care. And in fact, I think the trouble we're going to have is we're going to want to use it in the first line. And those studies are still cooking. But I would be really shocked if they're not positive. So in terms of immediate practice change, the moment the FDA approves this treatment, the practice has changed. Done. Overnight. Full stop.
It's really amazing. And the craziest part is just being able to target KRAS and RAS in general, it's going to have kind of a ripple effect around a lot of disease cases.
Well, you're coming from a time when people referred to these targets like RAS and TP53 as undruggable for a variety of reasons. I remember somebody was commenting that they had sent a grant in. The grant was rejected because they were basically told, why are you studying this molecule? There's never going to be a drug against it. This is pointless. And now we have a positive phase 3 trial that's giving us a therapy. And it's not just RAS, right? TP53 similarly has ongoing clinical trials that look like they are effective and working. So we're moving into a new era. We're learning more about biology. We're learning more about drug development. And really, you have to think, what is the future, what's the next line? You know, things like gene editing technology, right? I know there has been a lot of pushback and concern about that, but the sky's the limit in terms of the targets we can go after, the tools we can use to deploy them, and the potential benefit that we can give to patients.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. As the time of filming this, the full ASCO abstract lists are now. So I wanted to take this time to ask you, do you have any abstracts or presentations being shared that you want to talk about?
You know, I'm part of the Gut On Collab, right? So we host a podcast, and then we also provide mentorship to a number of trainees and folks interested in oncology. And as a result of that, mentorship network, I think we submitted something like 8 or 9 abstracts. So there's going to be some that are oral, some are going to be posters, some are online only. It happens. It's okay. But we'll have a number of things and some representation. Excited about one where we designed an LLM, natural language processing based tool that's helping us to ingest all of our patient data at Northwell in oncology so that we can do things like matching for clinical trials and ensuring patients are getting the right care at the right time. So that was a really significant effort and really excited about that and where that's developing and going.
That's fantastic. We'll definitely be on the lookout for that. It's always great hearing the specific use cases for where AI is being brought into practice nowadays. It's so interesting. I guess that this question is a bit, it's a bit broad, but just looking at ASCO, like, what are your general vibes around ASCO this year? Just like good, bad, like hopeful, you know?
I mean, I'm always hopeful going, seeing that progress is being made. It's always good. I think last year was, I dubbed it the year of the poop tube because like it felt like every oral was about colorectal cancer. This year, colorectal isn't on the plenary stage. PDAC is, that's great. But I'm really excited. I know that there's going to be a number of kind of high profile trials releasing information. I always just seeing people and finding out a little bit more about how we're going to do better against cancer in the future.
Fantastic, fantastic. So I do have a few other questions here that kind of diverge from this conversation a bit. First, you touched on cholangiocarcinoma before, and about 2 weeks ago, in early May, zenocutuzumab was approved in NRG1 fusion positive cholangiocarcinoma, and it didn't have a massive data set, ENENRGY, only had about 19 evaluable patients in that trial. Are you using that in practice, and is everyone getting it now? Or
so I am always grateful when I have a new targeted therapy in my armamentarium to look towards. I think the regulatory pathways for rare diseases is fascinating. The ability to get approvals on 19 patients is pretty wild. But at the same time, you know, I treat a lot of patients with appendiceal and anal cancer, right? And in those disease states, you're never going to have the 3,000 person phase 3 trial that you might expect for a disease like colon cancer. So it is necessary. I always applaud regulatory agencies for taking note of patient need in the face of really promising data. So should people be using this? Yes. Do we need to learn a little bit more about best practice in the clinics in terms of managing toxicity? Absolutely. Have I used it yet? I haven't. I haven't had a patient with cholangio and an NRG1 fusion. But, you know, the next patient I have with an NRG1 fusion, whether it's cholangio or not, I'm probably going to be trying to take a page out of Rochelle Kurzrock's playbook and saying, well, hey, maybe we should use this. Maybe this looks a little like cholangio. I don't know. In either way, trying to get approval for using a targeted agent. Because at the end of the day, if you have the target at a high variant allele frequency, it's probably a driver mutation, and it's probably going to be actionable in that disease state. That's what we've learned from a lot of different targeted therapies, and you know, hopefully we'll get more pan-cancer approvals.
Great. Throughout this conversation, we've touched a lot on specific targets and specific alterations. And recently I saw that you kind of co-authored a paper on PDAC that showed only 66% of patients were offered molecular or germline testing, I should say. And there were disparities between race, insurance status, and treatment setting. So I just wanted to like ask you about that and just kind of, you know, Yeah. What's the significance of that?
So this was something that also came out of the Gudonk Lab. And shout out to the PanCAN network for really helping to have a grassroots effort to generate this data. So Uday Graywall was the first author and really pushed this forward. It's terrifying to me that we're only testing half of patients, more or less, for these things. And these are patients that are generally pretty informed. They're answering a survey from a pancreatic cancer network, right? So the real rate is probably lower than this. You need to think about, well, what would the benefit be? Why do we do this? Well, we do it because we can detect things like 1-2% MSI. We can detect things like fusions that have approvals. We can detect things like HRD status, which changes our first-line treatment. And you need to wonder, you know, what are the reasons for this? So we're going to be releasing some other surveys around ASCO as well that are looking at similar things like 5-FU and DPYD and bolus practice, because we really want to try to understand why these aren't being offered, because you need to know the why in order to try to come up with some type of intervention to improve it. I think there's a number of reasons that this happens. I think it's very, very hard to be a general oncologist right now with the constant influx of new treatments, new data. I mean, you just mentioned 19 patients for NRG1 fusion. If you're seeing a full clinic panel 4.5 days a week, it is really hard to do that. And then to add on constantly reading, constantly ingesting information, that's even harder. So we need to figure out ways to make it easier. We need to figure out ways to make biomarker testing more accessible. And whether that's at the pathology level of automatically sending things or something else, I'm not sure. But I think it takes all hands on deck across allied health, not just oncology, but nursing, nurse practitioners, advanced practitioners in general, pharmacy, pathology. We need everyone educated as much as we can, and we need systems to work for us, not against us.
The multidisciplinary care forum is so important to have that everything in tandem is what we hear so much of. And that was kind of the last of my main questions. Is there anything else you might want to say to cap off this discussion?
It's an exciting time to be in healthcare. It's an honor to be able to take care of patients battling cancer. I'm grateful for the opportunity to do this and provide that care. I'm really hopeful for the future. You know, we're saying, oh, biomarker testing is low, but this is an opportunity to improve, and we gotta constantly work together to think about ways to do that. So I'm excited about the future. I'm looking forward to ASCO, finding out some new things, and just really excited for what the next generation of development brings.
Fantastic. Dr. Hornstein, thank you for taking the time to talk to us and visit the studio. We really appreciate having you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the Journal of Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @cancernetwork.